morning and happy Wednesday. Are you ready to rock and roll? Is it too early for you? I hope not, because I'm ready. That's right. So, Jim Ready Rocks, Wednesday morning special again. We're back. My name is Bay Ragney. You're here. I'm here. And guess who else is here? Punky Meadows. Well, he was here last week. Actually, I taped my interview with Punky last week, and I'm airing it today. What can you say? When you hear the name Punky Meadows, it's legend, icon, guitar great. The words just are endless that you can say about Punky. How about the King of Cool as well? Talented, amazing. The words can just keep going on and on. And it was truly an honor to get to be able to talk to a legend like Punky. And I got to thank Danny, our good friend Danny Farrow, who helped set this up as part of our little promotional series going on, because in case you haven't heard and you're living under a rock somewhere and you don't pay attention to what's really going on in the music world, Punky's back. He's got an amazing solo album that came out about a year and a half ago. It's called Fallen Angel. He's been doing shows, and he's teamed back up with the former frontman, the former lead singer, the former, I'd say also legend, icon, and King of Cool, Mr. Frank Demino. And they're doing shows. They're doing shows together. And they have some dates lined up in the next few weeks, beginning of April. They're going out to the West Coast in June, and they're working on filling dates up throughout the rest of the year, not just here in the States, but around the world. So stay tuned for more info on that. But like I said, I got to talk to Punky last week. And it's a great interview. It's a fun interview. We talked about everything and anything to do with Punky and Angel and music and ABBA and everything else. So I'm going to play that in a few minutes, but and it's a long one too. It's an hour long interview. So I hope you're ready to hang out with me for a while and listen to my voice and Punky's voice. And also let's do some music. All right, so I'm going to do some music and get right into the interview. So I hope you're ready. So let's do it. And again, let's go back in time in a few minutes. Let's kick it off with the reunion of sorts. It's great to hear these guys together again. This is on Punky's solo album. The solo album again is called Fallen Angel. This tune's called Lost and Lonely, and this is with Frank Demino of Angel on lead vocals.
Oh, and descend to earth and play it, for it is yours to bring forth sweet music, and they shall know you hereafter as Punky Meadows.
Is this the one and only Punky Meadows?
This is Punky. Is this Bay?
This is Bay. How are you doing, Punky? Nice to meet you, man.
Same here. I just ran to the door real fast. I was out. I said, oh, my God, it's 2 o'clock. I got to get my ass on the ball. So, I'm a little out of breath. I had to run upstairs real quick, but sorry about that. But I'm here.
That's all right. That's all that matters. You're here. So, you know, it's funny, like my quick Punky Meadows story. Back in like the late 80s, you know, the explosion of the whole hair band and heavy metal era. I was around 20 years old at the time, and I'm trying to put together a band and wanted to do something definitely with an image to it and all. And a friend of mine who I went through high school with for years was trying to put something together with this guy who had this look. And he finally, like, we sat down and he's like, look, he goes, here's what I want to do. He's like, it's got to be like Angel and Punky Meadows and melodic. I don't want to be doing hard rock and metal. I want to be melodic like Punky Meadows. And I was just like, can't you just like look like Punky and sound heavier? He's like, nope, it's got to be like Punky Meadows or nothing. So we never put it together, but.
Well, that's funny because actually we were pretty hard rock, especially our first two albums. You know, it was pretty hard rock. We started getting more kind of poppy and more melodic during the White Hot and Sinful albums. But actually, Angel, Hell of a Band, and On Earth as It Is in Heaven, those were all pretty hard rock records. You know, in fact, when the first Angel album came out, it was considered, they compared us to Led Zeppelin and meets Yes and that sort of thing. You know, but yeah, I'm a lover of melodic pop, you know, heavy pop, you know, music. I've always loved that kind of stuff, you know, because I grew up with the Beatles and stuff, you know, and
sure.
Raspberries. But then I also, you know, I mean, I cut my teeth on all the British blues guitar players, you know, Cream, Clapton, Beck, Page, Hendrix, and all those cats, you know, Gary Moore and David Gilmour. So, you know, all those guys were my influences, you know, and so I was, you know, I could be into ABBA, but I could also be into Led Zeppelin and Hendrix too. You know what I mean? So I had the
absolutely
the best of both worlds. And I just like all kinds of music. I mean, I'm a big country music fan. I love country guitar players, and I think they're great. And you know, so I just like music. I mean, when I was playing in bar bands, I would play in one bar for 3 years straight as a house band, and we had to play everything from Motown to country to British blues to rock. We had to play everything, and we did. And we also played our original songs too, and we did it all. And I loved playing all that stuff. I used to learn all the horn lines from Motown on my guitar, playing octaves, and I loved doing all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, I just dig music, you know. But I really have to say, I like a good song that you can sing along with, but yet that still kicks ass. You know what I mean? That
sure, but, absolutely.
Well, like that. If you listen to my latest solo album, all those songs on there. I don't know if you've heard it or not, but all those songs are very, very melodic and very commercial. I mean, they have, you know, great. I mean, the verses are melodic, great hooks. Yet the guitars and the bass and the drums are kicking ass. They're still screaming and pounding away, you know. And so, to me, that's the best of both worlds. You know what I mean? So, you know, I don't know. It's easier for me to sit around and write. I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna say I'm with you. I like you with the way best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's easier for me. It's easier for me to sit around. I think anybody can really write the heavy riff songs. I mean, I can sit on the couch all day long and write and call them a zillion licks that are, you know, that are really cool, you know, that are just licks, you know what I mean, and turn it into a song. But to sit down and write like a, you know, 4 or 5 minute song, you know, with great hooks and bridge and, you know, and verses and even my solos are, when I write a song, I write a whole different chord progression for my solos, so my solos kind of become almost another song in itself, you know what I mean, and try to keep those kind of and melodic too. Yet I still play off the cuff a lot, you know. But I kind of know where I want to go, you know. But yeah. So I mean, I like all kinds of music, but you know, it doesn't matter to me. But back to your question, we were a pretty hard rock band back then, you know, and the early stuff.
Now, one thing that really I'm dying to ask you about, because I've seen like it brought up in other interviews and all, but never really in depth, was you were actually, propositioned by the New York Dolls, I guess, at the Johnny Thunderslet.
Yeah, what happened was Mickey and I, you know, we had just put Angel together, and Mickey and I did an album called Bucks on Capitol Records, and Jack Douglas produced it. Jack Douglas was producing Aerosmith at the time and that sort of thing. And we were based out of Boston. The band was originally called Daddy Warbucks. We had to change it to Bucks because we couldn't use Daddy Warbucks. But anyway, so Jack Douglas was producing it. And through Jack Douglas, we met David Krebs, who managed Aerosmith. And I knew Tyler and all those guys because I lived in Boston.
Okay.
We lived in the same apartment building as Brad Whitford did. Him and his wife and my wife used to hang out together while Brad and I smoked pot and drank beer and wrote songs. But
nice.
But anyway, so we had this band together, and so I met David Krebs when I was doing Bucks, but then that band split up, and we put Angel together. Mickey and Greg put Angel together, and so you know, David, you know, called me up and said, hey, you know, I'd like for you and Mickey maybe to join the New York Dolls. I think you'd be great in that band. And we said, well, David, hey, listen, thanks a lot. I really appreciate the offer, but we have this band called Angel. We should come and see us. And so, of course, he came down to Sauce, and he freaked out, and, you know, he wanted to find the band right away, and Weyburn Krebs did, and so I was asked to take that spot, you know, but it never happened because of Angel. I just put Angel together.
Were you a fan of the band at all? I mean, did you like what they were doing, or?
Well, it's a funny thing. You know, they were kind of like, you know, a garage rock band, you know. I guess they were kind of like on the verge of maybe not quite a punk band, but they were more of a sleaze rock band, I guess you call them. I love their style. That's what I liked. I thought they were so cool because I was doing the same thing. It's funny because not knowing that the Dolls were doing that at that time, but, I mean, in D.C., where we know where I'm from, where I played and stuff, you know, I had just started. I was doing the glam thing. I mean, I started doing that, you know, back in like 73 or hanging around 73, I guess, because, you know, I saw Bowie and all that kind of stuff, you know. So I started, you know, putting the makeup on and doing my making my hair like that, you know, back then. I mean, I always had, you know, I mean, I always did my hair myself because I just always liked doing that kind of stuff. But so I was doing that anyway, and then I didn't know about the New York Dolls until later, you know, but when I saw them, I thought, wow, that's awesome, because before the New York Dolls and groups like Angel and Queen and Aerosmith bands were wearing, you know, back then they were like Lynyrd Skynyrd, but I mean, I love Lynyrd Skynyrd, don't get me wrong, I think they're a great band, but they were all wearing T-shirts and torn-up jeans and that sort of thing, and there wasn't much to look at. So when I saw the Dolls, I thought, awesome, you know, and I remember I saw that thing on HBO, I think, about the New York Dolls, with the bass player, I think, just before he died and stuff. And I remember that one of the fans said, before the New York Dolls, everything was in black and white, and then they came out and it was all color. And that's very true. It's a very true statement, because it just all of a sudden everything became like the Wizard of Oz, you know what I mean? Dorothy from black and white, you know, to landing on the, you know, in the old Dick Road with all the color everywhere. And it was like that. And so I dug that sort of thing. I mean, New York Dolls had their own thing going on. David Johansen's a cool guy, you know, and they were like a kind of just a dirty Rolling Stones kind of thing.
Sure.
So, I mean, you know, there's sometimes, you know, there's a thing that's called a sophisticated simplicity, you know. Maybe they weren't great, you know, players, but there was a certain sophistication to what they were doing, actually, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, I dug the Dolls, you know. You know, I dug the Dolls.
Now, it's kind of, I guess, like something that it you know, stuck with you through the years, because then I guess it was years later after Angel was done and you were working on another band, another project you had called Legend, and you were offered a spot in Kiss and Aerosmith, and you turned it down because of your loyalty, again, to what you were working on, and I guess like your belief in what you were doing.
Yeah, and that was with Greg, you know. I guess that was maybe a mistake. I don't know. I mean, you know, what can you say? But yeah, they, you know, they asked me to come down. I guess you know the story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, barely being the photographer that was Casablanca's photographer, he did us, and Kiss and everybody else. You know, they Kiss were playing, recording the studio, and they were looking for guitar playing. Barry said, "What about Punky to Gene?" And Gene said, "Well, that's awesome. That's a great idea." So Gene called me up, asked him, told me to learn a couple songs off the live album, come down and rehearse at SIR. So I went down there. When I walked into the studio, they were all playing. We were playing Communication Breakdown by Zeppelin. And
Oh, wow.
I walked in, and Eric Carr was on drums, and it was Gene and Paul, and I walked in, and we plugged up and played, and it went great. And Gene said, "Hey, let's sit down and talk business." And that's when I said, "Well, you know, Gene, you know, Greg and I have this thing that we're shopping a deal right now, you know, and I have to, and as soon as I said that, I guess I insulted Gene so bad. He said, "Come on, Paul, let's go." And he just walked. He just ran. They just left right away. Left me sitting there with Eric. And so, you know, I came back home, you know, and then Barry Levine called. He goes, "Punky, what'd you do?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, Gene and Paul came back with their jaws down on the floor." And Gene said, "No one has ever turned down Kiss." I said, "Barry, I didn't turn them down. I didn't say yes or no. I just told them that, you know, I was working with Greg right now, you know, and that's all I had to say." And then Gene just took off, you know. And so he said, "Well, they were going to give you $160,000 a year plus points and all that kind of stuff." I said, wow. So, but, you know, well, I don't know. Like I said, I guess I just insulted Gene. He's got a very big ego, you know what I mean? And I guess he thought I was just going to, you know. And maybe I would have said yes, you know, but I didn't have time to say yes or no. I was just, I guess, like I said, I insulted him so bad. So that's cool. Water under the bridge now.
Going into that, though, I mean, did you think to yourself, like, wow, like, what would I be putting makeup on? Like a whole different world.
Yeah, I did think of that. You know, I didn't know what I was going to be. You know, because at that time they weren't using Ace's look. You know, they had to use something different.
Right.
And so I don't. Yeah, I mean, I thought about it. I made some jokes and really, you know. Stupid jokes like maybe I'll be the elephant or something. I made some stupid jokes like that, you know. But you know, it wasn't really funny. but it would have been a whole different thing. I mean, who knows what would have happened? But it would have been a different thing for Kiss too, you know, because I would have brought it
right
a bit of a different thing into that band. But it would have been. I think it probably could have been cool, you know. Because I was more of a guitar player that they really wanted. They wanted a blues-based guitar player, which is really what I am, you know, kind of a blues country-based guitar player. It's really what I am. I mean, guitar player is what I am. And so, you know, that's what they were really looking for, because at the time, you know, everybody was doing all that tapping on the frets and all that kind of stuff and all the classical,
right,
classically influenced stuff, you know, and they really, you know, Kiss was really more of a blues-based band, you know, so that would have fit. That's why I think when they got back together after their Unplugged thing and Ace and Peter came on, everybody went crazy and they went back to their roots, you know, which everybody, that's what everybody
right.
thought Kiss, you know, so.
You know, after that, I mean, after Legend didn't happen, I guess you kind of like almost went to a hiding, or you just left the music at that point, or?
Yeah, I put another kind of band together with Frank and Barry and Paul Raymond from UFO, and we had this this project together, I was in David Joseph, the man, our manager used to manage us before, was interested in managing this group that I had with Frank, Barry, and Paul Raymond. And so he was going to set up for us to do a showcase at the Whiskey. And then Frank, for some reason, wound up running off to Japan with Paul Raymond to do something. And so at that point, I said, okay, I'm kind of fed up with the music business. I've had enough, you know what I mean? So I just packed up. I lived with a stripper on Hollywood Boulevard for about 2 months. And then I just packed up and went back east to where, you know, to D.C. or Virginia, where I'm from. I wanted to get out of the music business. I mean, I love playing music. I never stopped playing music. I mean, that's in my blood. It's not something I want to do. It's something I have to do. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I never stopped playing. I mean, I play every single, I play every single night. Nobody can watch TV with me because I have my guitar and I play along with the commercials and the TV shows and I have a tape recorder beside me and I come up with these ideas and I record it right away and I'm writing songs. So I'm pretty prolific like that. But I never stopped playing. I just, what happened was like, I really got into country music because, you know, from D.C., you know, I grew up around from Virginia and Maryland. I grew up around a lot of guys who played country guitar, and I was always so impressed when I'd watch them play. Guys like Danny Gatton, who, you know, can't watch that guy and just flip out. And he was a friend of mine, you know what I mean? So, you know, so I really got into the whole country scene, which was fun because, it, you know, it, I just kind of woodshedded all that kind of, because I love playing that kind of music, all those steel guitar bends and stuff, and you got to be playing pretty clean.
Right.
You can't hide behind distortion, you know what I mean? And you got a finger
sure.
pick, and you got, you know, and I love the way they play. And like Brad Paisley, guys like that, it's kicked me in the ass when I went to them play. I start laughing because they're so good, you know what I mean? So that was always like a little bit of an influence of mine anyway from growing up hearing that stuff, because one of the first songs I heard when I was a kid was Big Bad John. You know what I mean? Jimmy Dean, you probably don't know that song, but anyway, that was, you know, that's kind of what I grew up listening to, that, and you know, and the Washington, Maryland, Virginia area. But so I really got into Vince Gill and all those cats, and Marty Stewart and all those great guitar players and everybody, and I started dumping way back, and Buck Owens and all those cats, you know, and all the guitar players and stuff, and that's pretty much all I did. I have a really nice Telecaster, and I played that pretty much all the time, and then I had my tanning salons. I had the tanning salons. I did really, really well with those. I had four of those. Did really good with those, and made good money, and my own boss, and so, you know. But I kept playing. I had one of my guitar down at my main tanning salon. I had my guitar down behind the counter, so it was quiet in the morning. And when it wasn't even there, I played my guitar along with the TV up there, you know, country channel station and stuff, you know. And so, but it was cool, and I did that for about 11 years. I did really good, and then I wound up selling those to this Peruvian group, made a lot of money on that, and I got into the stock. Oh, I had already gotten to the stock market anyway before that. Well, I had the hands on stock market and properties and things like that. And so then I retired. You know, retiring, moved down to Charlotte. I sold the tanning salons and put everything I made on the properties too, and I put all that into the stock market as well. And I was retired, doing really, really well. And then, of course, the big crash came in 2008.
Sure.
So, stock market crash, which, you know, I never left the stock market, but I lost about 35% of my portfolio, so I couldn't keep draining money out of that. So I ended up going back to work for this company, you know, that what my neighbors had, a medical company, which was really cool. And I had my own, I had an office, and I had a corporate job, you know. I was sitting in front of a computer doing webinars and all kinds of crazy stuff, and dealing with doctors and lawyers and nurses and that sort of thing. And and then I got the offer to do the solo album, and I said, yeah, let's do it. I can't wait. It's going to be fun. So I did that, and here we are. And the album did really well. I was really happy because, you know, it charted on the four Billboard charts. It sold well. And, you know, the album was paid back in 2 weeks after, you know, it first came out. And everybody was digging it. Got rave reviews all over the world. It was to have a deal in Japan
sure.
and also in Europe. And everybody loved the album. So I was so happy, you know. And then we went out and started playing some. Of course, my first show we did at B.B. King's, and I was like a deer in the headlights. So I hadn't played on stage for so long, you know. But the band, they're all great musicians, and they're all great guys. And of course, Danny, you know, Danny Farrow is my partner in crime. He's my buddy, and we're brothers, you know. And we have this great chemistry together, you know, writing, because he likes the same thing I do. He likes David Cassidy as well, you know what I mean? But still loves the heavy stuff too. So, you know, we get along on that. Because I remember when I went out with Angel, and I really love that ABBA song, and they said, you like ABBA, those guys aren't heavy. What's wrong with you? And I said, they're fucking... And I started singing like, you know, I started singing SOS, and I can't stop singing. I just like it. I can't help it, you know? What I'm supposed to do is just say I don't like it because it's not heavy. I mean, good song is a good song. So that was cool about Danny and I, you know, because he likes real heavy shit, too. But he also loves all that poppy stuff as well. And like Cheap Trick, I love Cheap Trick and those kind of bands, you know. And the Raspberries, of course, when that song Go All the Way is my all-time favorite pop song ever. Every time I hear it, the hair on my arm stands up, you know, when they sing that chorus, you know. So you know, I just love, I love, you know, the heavy guitar. Hendrix is my favorite. Stevie Ray Vaughan is my favorite guitar player ever. When I want to get a hard on, I put Stevie Ray Vaughan on. I just, oh my God, my dick gets hard, you know, because he's just so fucking great. He's just, you know, he just channels music somehow. And same with Hendrix, you know, and all those cats, you know. So Gary, and you know, I love David Gilmour, you know, he can play one note, man,
sure.
and it means more than a thousand notes that most guys play, you
Absolutely.
Know what I mean? So you know, I like all that kind of stuff. Yet I like the guys that can you can rip it up too, you know what I mean? So, you know.
If Danny didn't come along, do you think you ever would have
probably not. No, probably not. I mean, because you know what spurred that whole thing on was you know, I had met Danny when I had my tanning salon. He was a big fan, and he came down. I didn't know him, but he came, because this is before Facebook and stuff, you know.
Sure.
And he came down to Virginia with a friend, and he introduced himself, and we met, and he was really nice. He brought me some Angel truck down, some Angel stuff down that he had collected. He's a collector, you know. And he was a big fan, you know, and so he was really nice. So we got along, and then he left and went. You know, went back to Jersey, and then I did my tanning thing, and then I like I said, I retired, moved to North Carolina, and then Facebook came along, I got on Facebook and I started seeing how all these angel groups and stuff, all these angel fans, how much they loved Angel and stuff. And I didn't really realize that because, you know, when you're before social media, you know, you play in a town and say, hey, you guys are great tonight, and say, oh, thanks a lot. And then you move on to the next town, but you never hear from those people again. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You move on to
sure.
the next town, and move on to the next town. But then when I got on Facebook, all these people from all these different towns and all the United States and even the world, you know, Japan and Switzerland, places like that, France, they all started saying how much they loved Angel. They would start posting all these pictures and stuff, and I went, wow, that was pretty cool. And then, so, because Angel left a bad taste in my mouth at the end there, you know what I mean? I didn't even want to talk about it, you know. But, you know, just because of the business, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so, you know, I started seeing it. I said, wow, that's really cool. So I started really digging it again. Then I started kind of missing it, you know what I mean, wanting to play again. But like I said, I never stopped playing anyway. But then Danny, I got hooked up with Danny again through Facebook. We started talking off and on and stuff like that. And Danny said, hey, would you like to do an interview, you know, on with the Rat Radio? People would like to hear from you. I haven't heard from you so long. And I said, sure, I'll do it with Keith Roth. And so we did that interview, and afterwards, you know, their server because it was hurtling the world that particular interview. Their whole server crashed because everybody was trying to tune into it to hear it.
Holy cow!
And they finally got it back up, and I was on Facebook at the same time because it was pre-recorded, and so I could see what was going on Facebook at the same time. And so then Keith Roth came on, and under all these comments afterwards about how great the interview was, everybody was so happy to hear me talking. Keith Roth said, out of his 17 years of working at the Rat Radio, doing interviews with Jimmy Page, you know, all these different great rock stars, he said he'd never, ever seen that happen where the whole server crashed. And so I was dumbfounded myself. I don't know why, but I guess it's because people wanted to hear, because they haven't heard from me, I guess, for so long. I'm just curious, maybe. But anyway, so because of that, you know, I started getting a lot of interest and stuff. People wanted to say, hey, maybe you should do an album and stuff, you know. And then, of course, Danny and Keith offered me that deal. And I said, yeah, it'd be great. If I love Danny, and, you know, he's a musician, and he's not a record company exec kind of guy. I just don't trust,
right.
You know what I mean? I trust those guys, and they're musicians, and they're my brothers, you know what I mean? So I said, yeah, let's do it. You know, we had complete, you know, creative control. I got to produce and arrange, and Dan and I wrote all the songs, produced, arranged, did the artwork, the cover artwork and stuff. And so we had complete control, and we put a band together pretty quickly, you know, and you know, recorded the record, and it just went great. It was a lot of fun. It was just, I was back in the groove again. I said, well, this is, why did I ever quit? Because I love it so much, you know what I mean? But I just
right.
think I just think because of the bad experiences you have, you know what I mean, when you're out there in L.A. swimming with all the sharks, you know, and you finally, you know, you have enough, you know, and you say, that's it. And then when I did my tanning salon things, I was happy because I was on the Chamber of Commerce. People knew me around town. I did really well. And I still kept my look, you know what I mean? Only my hair was, I had blonde streaks going through it. So I was like, look like a surfer dude, you know what I mean?
Okay.
The whole tanning thing. So like a surfer dude, you know. I had all these beautiful girls working for me, and you know, and I was in upper class scale neighborhoods. All my tanning salons were. I was in, you know, upper scale tanning salon neighborhood. So I did really well with that, and I was real happy with that, you know. And you know, so, you know, I had to reinvent myself. You know, I didn't want to be one of those people that were, you know, sitting in the gutter somewhere saying, I used to be a musician and I was this guy, and now
right.
I'm, I can't, you know. So I picked myself up, and I actually was a DJ for 6 years when I first came back to D.C. at a nightclub called the Crazy Horse, because I had to get my shit together, make some money, and try to get some credit set up. And so I did that for 6 years, and I was good at that too. You know, I brought in all that hip hop music and stuff, you know. And I remember I was DJing up there one time, and Marty Freeman came in, and he was a big, big fan. He came on the stage, and he goes, dude, man, I love you. Fucking great. I said, well, and I was kind of embarrassed, you know what I mean? Because here I'm a DJ now, spinning other people's music, and I'm not playing them, just spinning the records. Even though I did it well, you know, I had been dancing and all that kind
right.
of stuff. But that's something I had to do. I didn't want to wind up in the gutter, so I had to, you know, I had to reinvent myself, pull myself up, and do something. And once I got that,
sure.
got credit established, and then I was able to open up, do what I wanted to do. You know, I kind of stumbled into the tanning salon business by accident because I went to a tanning salon one time. One winter, and I thought, well, this is a dumpy place, but if you had a nice place, you could make a lot of money, and I did that, and it turned out really well, so luckily that was good. But, you know, that's what life does. Those curves, and you just have to, you know, reinvent yourself and do whatever you got to do it, you know. Here I am making full circle, and playing again, so it's awesome, too.
Now, how about, like, during that time, though, like I guess that was probably around the 80s and all with the tanning salons, or was
yeah, I came well, I came back. I left in 88 and came back to
okay
to DC, and then I was a DJ for 6 years there in Georgetown at the Crazy Horse, and after that in 95 I opened up my first tanning salon, and then
so
I get that
still
to
you were still out in LA then during the explosion of the whole scene then, right?
You mean the 80s scene?
Yes.
What scene? Oh, yeah. I was out there, yeah. So, I mean, I that's when, you know, when Kiss asked me to join them and I was doing Legend and all that kind of stuff, you know, with Greg. And what happened was I actually went back, came back east. My girlfriend and I came back east because I was going to put the band together back up in Boston, well, New Hampshire, and I had some people there, so... We rented a beach house in New Hampshire, Seabrook, New Hampshire, and in the wintertime, and we put this band together. We were going to do that, but that didn't work out. And so I went from there to New York City, and I met Bill LaCoyne there. And Bill LaCoyne wanted to revamp Angel. We were going to do that, but Bill LaCoyne was so fucked up on cocaine and stuff and everything else. He was freaked out. That didn't work out. And so that's. And so then I wound up going back out to L.A. because barely being home. I said, hey, let's come back out here. So I went back. I wound up going back out to L.A. in 85. And I lived in a house with Barry Levine and a bunch of cats. And then I lived in Malibu for the last 2 years out there. We tried to put Angel together. That's when the whole thing, when I talked with Paul Raymond and all that kind of stuff. That was like from, I guess, well, from probably from about 86 to 88, I guess, is when that all took place. And so we were putting that whole thing together, which didn't work out. And then after that, then I just said, that's it. I'm done. I'm leaving
right.
town, and you know, and I'm going to start anew, and that's what I did. So you know, I didn't look back. You know,
did you?
I'm proud of what I did.
You
know, I'm proud of what I did. You know, it builds character. You know, you learn that. You know, you're a lot stronger than you think you are. You're a lot stronger than you think you are. You know what I mean? You can't put all your eggs in one basket all the time. You know, it's
right.
So you know, I learned a lot about myself, which is good. You know, so no regrets.
Yeah. I'm guessing, I mean, did it kind of like, you know, with trying to do the Angel thing over and over, like, and it not working out, and you're seeing all these bands around you start blowing up, like, say, like a Motley Crue or a Rat or somebody like that, did that kind of get even more discouraging? Like,
well, you know, it did. In a way, you know, but all those guys were influenced by Angel. I remember when I had Angel, it was Greg and I and Ricky Phillips. And we had a revamped Angel. It's Greg, Ricky Phillips, who plays with Styx now. He was in the Babies. And Fergie Ferguson, who was a singer. He sang with Toto and a great, great, great singer. We had a band together there, and we were rehearsing at SIR. And Motley Crue hadn't got a record yet, but they were really big in the Sunset Strip. They were playing the Whiskey, and they were like, you know, the next Kiss and that sort of thing. And Tommy and Vince came in when we were recording, and they just loved Angel. They loved me too. I remember Tommy was I was showing the guys how to play this song, and Tommy was hitting Vince at the knobs, checking me out, and how cool it was. You know what I mean? So I was kind of, you know, I was happy for those guys at the same time. But you know, they had MTV, and that's what broke all those bands. Angel didn't have MTV. If we would have had
right.
MTV back then, we would have exploded. You know, so you know that that's what happened, you know, with that. If Angel, back in those days, you had to just tour everywhere to be seen, you know, by everybody, you know. And that's, you know, I mean, bands were broken overnight with MTV because they would play 24 hours a day, you know, all day long.
Right.
You know what I mean? So people were just breaking left and right in there. So that was a big explosion because it was just oversaturated even almost, you know what I mean? But it was discouraging because Angel wasn't the Angel, you know, that it was in the beginning. I mean, I guess people have asked me if we'd put Angel together again, and I said I would never do it unless it's the original band and somebody bankrolled it and put some money behind it and made it a great stage show like Angel was, and we did that sort of thing. I would never want to cheapen it and you know, try to go out as, you know, some kind of Angel that's really not Angel, you know what I mean? And
right,
so,
right.
You know, so that was the story with that, really, because we didn't have MTV, and putting Angel, the different Angels back together just never worked because of artistic egos that are fragile, you know what I mean, and things happening, and people, some people were doing drugs and stuff like that, you know, things just
sure
didn't work out at that time, and that also discouraged me too, you know what I mean, because, you know, I'd get so close to doing things with these guys, and then something would fall apart because somebody was fucked up or something, you know what I mean? They couldn't get their act together. And And so, you know, actually, when Greg got his deal, he got his deal from a demo that, because I was with Greg with David Glenn Isley and Legend. It was David Glenn Isley and Greg myself. And
right.
But that was taking forever. We shopped demos to them. Nobody would take it. You know what I mean? So, and that got to the point where we really weren't doing anything. And that's kind of like, and that's when I first left L.A. And I said, well, I'm going to go back east and try something back there. And then, of course, that didn't work back there. Then went back out to L.A. again, you know, a traveling minstrel, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
But, you know.
And then Greg broke with Jafriat.
Yeah, he did,
like,
yeah.
What's going on here?
Well, you know what? When that happened, to tell you the truth, you know, I was already successful with my tanning salons and stuff, and I was really happy, and I really didn't, because I know what goes on in that business. And I was happy for him, but I didn't really miss that. I was happier for me because I was having a hell of a good time. I was making money. I was very popular in the town. Like I said, all the cops knew me. Everybody knew me. You know what I mean? And I was still
right.
kind of a rock star in my own right in that town there. You know, in Vienna, Virginia, which was a very upscale neighborhood and stuff. And I had a nice house, a big pool in the backyard. I was driving new cars. You know, and all that kind of. And I was happy. You know, and I didn't have that anxiety of hoping your next record's going to sell or whatever and all that kind of stuff. You know, and I talked to Greg, you know, and that's why when he, after the Jafriat thing, he got out of the business and never went back because he just said he would never play music again because it's just a fucked up business, you know. And so,
right.
You know, yeah, seeing that made me kind of envious, you know what I mean, but only for a few seconds because somebody would call me and say, hey, Punk, you got to come down to the tanning salon. We got a customer here, then blah, 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 you know what I mean? So, you know, and I'd be on to that, man. So, yeah, I'll be right down, you know what I mean, or whatever, you know, and I had fun. For me, looking at tanning beds was like looking at cars and guitars, you know, checking all the curves out and the lights and all that kind of stuff.
Sure,
you know, it was fun.
Sure.
I mean, I'm very focus-minded, and when I get into something, I really get into it, and so, you know, I got into all that, and I was the first upscale tanning salon to open up in that area, and it put all the other tanning salons out of business, you know, and I had lamp lines around the block when I went open up, when I first opened up, and I did
wow.
really, really well, and that's why when I sold it for a bunch of money, but you know what, as soon as I sold it, a year later, those guys went out of business because they didn't know how to run it. Because when I would make money, I put money back into the salon all the time, buying new equipment and doing upgrades. And I was
right.
first one to have the Mystic Tan, spray tan. I was first one to have that after it was showcased on Friends and those TV shows and stuff, you know. So I knew what I was doing, and I really got into it. I loved it. It was a fun business, you know. So I was a little envious when I saw Greg, but at the same time, I said, but I'm happy now, man. Don't be envious, Punky. Just be grateful and thankful that what you're doing now is working, and that's how I looked at it. And I got to go home every night, you know, and my girlfriend and my dogs and my cats, you know what I mean, and my pool, and you know, I was having fun, you know. So,
now, you mentioned anxiety, you know, of the music business and hoping you're going to sell albums and stuff like that. Did you have that feeling at all once your solo album came out? Because now it's your name on the marquee, not the whole band of Angel.
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't as much anxiety because, you know, back then I was just a musician, you know, and so, you know, you were only as good as that your record, you know what I mean? And so, but I had to retire and I didn't have to worry about making money, you know what I mean? So I wasn't desperate.
Right.
And I think when you're desperate, you know, you make wrong decisions because you have to because you would sign anything. I'll sign any contract, you know what I mean, just because I'm desperate. I need to. But I wasn't desperate this time around, you know. I mean, I can make it on my – because I still have my stock portfolio and stuff like that, you know. And so – and I had that job at the time, so I didn't quit that job until after the record came out, and I realized I couldn't work anymore because I was playing and touring a lot and stuff like that. So I knew I couldn't keep doing that. And they were really good to me, and they paid me a lot of money. And like I said, they're my neighbors, and they have this total medical compliance business, and they're really good to me. So you know, we parted on good terms, you know, and I went and did my thing. But I wasn't desperate, you know. So I didn't have the anxiety. Wasn't quite as bad. I was nervous at first when after we finished, they say, okay, well, it's being released. I said, oh God, okay, well, I hope it goes. But pleasantly enough, you know, right away it started selling, and people were, you know, talking, saying great things about it, you know, on Facebook and stuff. So that kind of alleviated those worries. But you're always concerned about that kind of thing, like, you know,
sure.
anything, you know what I
sure.
mean? But you know, but like I said, I wasn't desperate. Like there was a time, like I remember when Frank and Barry came down when I had my tanning salons to Virginia one time, and they were trying to get this Japanese record deal, and they wanted me to play on some tracks, and I said, they were up in New York, and I said, no, I'm out of the scene, I'm not doing it anymore, I don't want to do it, but I wish you guys luck. And then Barry, what happened was Barry and Frank wound up coming down to Virginia, And they knocked on, they found out where I lived, they knocked on my door, and there they were. You know what I mean? And so they begged me. They said, listen, you know, we'll come down here, you know, we'll get a recording studio down here, and we'll go a couple days rehearsal, and because we can't get this Japanese deal unless you're in the band. They want, you have to be part of the band, or we can't get it. So I said, okay, guys, I'll do it. So we had 4 days, 2 days in the studio to rehearse, you know. And so I said, one condition, I'm going to write some songs for this record. They said, okay, fine. So I wrote a couple songs and went to rehearsals, and we did the rehearsals, and it was okay. And then we went in and we recorded the four tracks. And then their manager at the time came in, and this is crazy, came in to me afterwards and wanted me to sign a contract paper saying that I wouldn't have any I wouldn't own any of the songs. I wouldn't have any rights to anything on this record. And I looked at him and I said, are you kidding me? I said, I'm not going to fucking sign that. And I said, there was a time when maybe I was desperate I would have signed it, but I'm not going to sign it. You got your fucking mind, get lost. And Felix looked at me, and Felix was there too. Felix said, well, I already signed it. Can I, what am I going to do? I said, I don't know, Felix, but I'm not going to sign that damn thing. You know, so I didn't sign. And then once again, all it did was just show me again how shitty the music business was. Here I am, trying to do a favor, and this manager, weasel manager guy, comes out and decides he wants me to sign, relinquish all rights to everything that we just did, because he's afraid I was going to come back and say I want money because my songs are on the record or whatever that. I never would have done anything. I didn't need the money. You know what I mean? But just the fact that he had the nerve to do that, I thought, man, that's why I don't want to be in the music business. So that just solidified my whole. And so I went back to my tanning salon, was happy as a goat eating shit, while those guys are trying to get a deal somewhere and trying to, which never happened, I don't think. But I mean, I don't know what happened with that. But it's always that. It's those kind of war stories. I mean, you know, the Beatles sold all their rights off to Michael Jackson. You know what I mean? He has their rights. And it's happened to every group back in the day, because it's not a level playing field. You know, you're not a legal mind, and musicians just want to play music and have a good time, right, and have fast cars and that kind of shit, and fuck the groupies. You know what I mean? And,
right.
And so all these lawyers and stuff, you know, that you're just a kid. You know what I mean? And all these lawyers take advantage of you, and they might have you signing away. You know, well, we need $100,000 to get on the road tour. Okay, we'll sign this, and you can have $100,000. You know, and so you wind up signing away your publishing, and your publishing really is your social security. You know, when you get older, I mean, it's like
right.
Like say, finally my published, say Wild and Hot became a big hit. Well, if I own my publishing, I'm going to get the money for that in later years. You know what I mean? But if I don't own it,
right.
Somebody else is going to get it. You know what I mean? So, you know, I own all my publishing now. But, you know, so it's all those things, you know, it makes you cynical, you know, about the music business. And that cynicism is learned from experience. You know what I mean? And so it's a cruel world out there. Like Frank Conley, he used to manage Aerosmith. He once said to me, I needed some money. He wanted to, he was going to manage the Daddy Warbucks. And I said, and I had my wife and kid up in Boston. I needed some rent money. I said, Frank, I need some rent money. You know, I got to feed my wife, my kids. And then we were recording this album for Capitol Records at the time, too. And Frank looked at me and goes, well, you know, Funky, it's a cruel world out there. And I was kind of pissed off because I thought, wow, this dude doesn't even want to invest in me like that. You know what I mean? And,
right.
And so I walked away from that feeling really bad about that. But, you know, he was fucking right. You know, it actually kind of taught me a lesson. But you know, you make those mistakes over and over again because you're just, like I said, you're a kid, you're young, you know, you just want to make it, and you know, and you want to play music, and that's all you can think about, you know. And so, you know, that's just the way it goes. Man.
Were people trying to hunt you down over the years, like for offers like that, or?
Not really, because I kind of, like, there wasn't Facebook, like I said, back then, you know. Now, there were people, there were fans that would show up, that would show up to my tanning salon. Some guys came from Germany one time, and they got down on their knees, and they were saying, we're not worthy, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. And it was really funny. I was always slightly embarrassed by that kind of stuff, but I would have people show up, and the people in my town there knew who I was from Angel, and then all the people that knew me, they were fans, so they knew me, so that was cool. But nobody from the record business, really, because, you know, I was out of the business, and I was gone. You know, you have to either be in L.A. or in New York really to be involved in the record, in the music scene. You know, pretty much. You know,
right.
And I was in Virginia, so but it was fine. I didn't care. I was glad to be away from it.
Did you think at any time, like you mentioned, how you really got into country music over those years? Did you think about ever doing maybe a country album?
Well, I always fantasized. I mean, don't get me wrong. I fantasized about playing again. I was thinking, let me put together a little power trio and just do some nightclubs around town, that sort of thing. You know what I mean? that
right.
kind of thing, you know. And I mean, I always fantasized about it, but my business took up all my time, you know what I mean? And so I never really did it. And I would watch the Grammys and all the award shows, and I would have my speech written one day when I got up there, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But they were just fantasies, you know what I mean? And I got, you know, the thing is, I love playing guitar, so I can sit on my couch and play my guitar and have just as much fun doing it there as I can on stage. I mean, yes, I'm very. I learn new stuff all the time. You know, you kind of stagnate when you make it to a certain level, because once you get to a certain level, you know, you're not really learning anymore. You're performing on stage. You're jumping around performing, and you're playing the same stuff over and over again. It's when you kind of get downtime to yourself. You sit down and you start learning. Hey, I want to try this. I want to learn a few jazz licks, a few jazz chords. You know, I want to learn some cool country bending licks and all that kind of stuff. You know, I want to help with finger pick better and that sort of thing. That's when you really. And so I would always get very. I would watch Marty Stewart every Saturday night, and Marty Stewart's a killer fucking guitar player, you know. And I'd watch him on the RFD channel, and I still do, you know, and steal all his licks. I watch him play last time. I'm taking that fucking lick. That's cool as shit, man. You know, and so, you know, I would learn his licks and stuff and put them into my vocabulary, you know, and I was very happy, man. I would get excited. I couldn't wait to play and all that kind of stuff. And I'm still, to this day, every day after dinner, I'll sit down and I'll watch Family Feud, and then I'll run downstairs and pull my car and start watching TV and playing along with everything. And I look forward to it I do it every single night. It's just something I do, you know what I mean? It's kind of like talking to an old friend. I'll just sit there and rip out the awards and shit, you know. And so, you know, it's just something you have to do. And so I love playing guitar. And so that, and I was saying to Danny, I said, listen, Danny, if this stuff's being fun, then I don't want to do it anymore. As long as it's fun, you know, we'll do it. But when it starts getting into, you know, the music business weasels and that sort of thing, and it starts getting that point, then I don't want to do it anymore, you know. So, but so far, you know, it's been because Danny really is you know, a great guy. I love him to death, you know, and he's really, you know, spearheaded a lot of this stuff, and he's actually pretty good at managerial stuff too, you know what I mean? So he's pretty much been managing me at the same time. Even though I have a manager, Danny really does manage me better than the manager does, you know. Because Danny loves me, you know what I mean, and I love him, you know what I mean. So he looks out for me, you know. So, you know.
Did Danny make you a doll?
Yeah, I got two of them. They're really cool. He made those a long time ago, but he gave me two of them. One with a white strat, one with a black strat. I have it sitting in my music room downstairs. It's like a library music room, and I have it sitting down there with my other things.
That's awesome.
He's great. Danny's really multi-talented. The guy is a great sculptor. You know, he's a great songwriter. He's a really good guitar player too. You know, and he's a good singer, you know what I mean? He also, like I said, he's got good business smarts, you know, about things like that. So he's a pretty special guy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now going back to the music business part and all, with the music business being the way it is and where you could do most of the stuff, I mean, pretty much yourself today, right? You got Danny doing everything for you, helping you. Do you like it like that instead of being, say, signed to, you know, back in the 70s to a Casablanca or something like that?
Well, you know, it's got its pros and cons. I mean, of course, like I said, when you were signing Casablanca, and you know, everything was taken away from us, and we you know, are publishing and stuff like that. But at the same time, being on a big label like that, well, Casablanca was a very small label when we first went with them. They didn't have anybody. In fact, Neil Bogart was going bankrupt, basically. You know, he started Casablanca. He had a CD out, not a CD, but a record out with Johnny Carson, you know, a comedy album out, and didn't do anything. And he was struggling, but, you know, of course, we heard about Neil and stuff, and he had Kiss, and Kiss, I guess you know that story, Kiss Falls, and saw Angel in D.C. We first put the band together, and they raved about it. They loved Angel and stuff when they saw Gene and Paul and those guys. They came down and saw us because they were playing in D.C., and they loved the band. And so when we were shopping a deal, you know, we just went out to L.A., and it was all this talk about Angel and stuff, you know. Went out there, we were going to start showcasing a bunch of our companies in there. Our manager said, well, there's this new company called Casablanca, and Kiss is on this label, and we might want to get you know, look at them because they're a smaller label to put more behind you as opposed to being on a big label like Capitol, and, you know, you get lost in the roster, you know what I mean, so to speak.
Right.
I guess you know the story. We called Neil up, and Neil said, yeah, I'll tell you what, you can play with Kiss on Anaheim. They're playing, I'll check Angel out and see how I like them and that sort of thing, and then let me call Gene and find out. Of course, he calls Gene. He calls back later. He says, I'll tell you what, I'll sign the band sight unseen because Gene Simmons says, and in no way will Angel ever open up for Kiss. So that kind of, you know, he was going to sign us anyway, I think. But that's, you know, that's kind of how that's how that story went. And so we went to Casablanca, and they just had like this house up in Hollywood Hills, you know, with different bedrooms allocated to different parts of the record business, you know what I mean? Like the art department, and they were able to be smoking pot up there. It was really cool. It was a small family, and, you know, Neil was always smoking pot, stone crazy, you know, and playing the latest stuff he was signing up. And then, of course, Kiss finally broke with the Kiss Alive album after, what, five records, I guess, you know. And then, of course, he did
right.
the whole disco thing. He did the whole deal with Donna Summer and all that stuff. And then he became the golden boy of Hollywood. And Casablanca became huge. And then he got the film works and all that kind of stuff, you know. And Neil Bogart was a great guy. I loved Neil, you know. But once he got the axe, Casablanca was never the same. And that's when Angel fell apart because, you know, we were in the Casablanca about 1.5 million, and Neil loved the band, and he always said, you know, listen, you guys are going to, you know, you're going to win this war. It was the last meeting we had with him, and, you know, and he listened to the album. He loved the album and the whole thing, the new album we were going to put out. And then shortly after that, he got the axe for misappropriation of funds, I guess. And then what happened was Casablanca was just run by a bunch of college kids, you know, and they weren't promoting anything, they weren't doing anything, and shortly, of course, they fell apart after a while. But we couldn't do anything either as Angel because we were still on a contract to Casablanca, so we couldn't get a record deal anywhere else. So, you know, we couldn't shop a deal to be able. And so what happened was we all got frustrated, so we splintered off. Kind of Greg and I went in one direction, and Frank and Greg Barry and I went in one direction, and Frank went in another direction with Paul Raymond and those cats, you know, and that sort of thing. And then that's kind of was the evolution of what happened to Angel while we split up, you know. And so, you know, again, the record business, you know what I mean? But, you know, it was too bad because Angel was, you know, when we first got together, we were a gang, and we really had something special, you know, and we created all that stuff ourselves, you know, the big Ben-Hur opening and stuff like that. Greg and Frank and Barry and I went down to this local record store. We said, we got to find a little opening song for the, you know, to put on the, we got that Ben-Hur theme soundtrack. We had that blasting over the speakers of this little tiny club, and we had flash bombs going off and all kinds of shit. And I remember when the flash bombs would go off, all the bottles and glasses would fall off the shelf back by the bar. Because we wanted more concussion, we didn't care about. We wanted your chest to shake when those things went off, you know. So, but the owner of the bar didn't care because we were drawing such a big crowd, you know what I mean? And it kind of happened quickly for us from that. But we were a gang, Angel was. And we were all together. And then, of course, you know, when you get into Hollywood, people start pissing in your ear and say, you're the star. No, you're the star. You don't need these guns, that sort of thing. And people start believing that kind of shit, like Greg, whatever, you know what I mean? And then, you know, you start, you know, and then this is what happens. You know, things fall apart, unfortunately. You know, I think it's, you know, it's bad timing for Angel, really. We were just a little prematurely in the game. If we would have came out when MTV was, like I said, first hit, well, it would have been a different story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now you and Frank are back together. You're going to do some shows this year.
Yeah,
it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, we're going to do it. People have been asking us to do that for a long time because Frank put a solo album out, you know, and I did too. And so, you know, when we got together at that we did that hair metal award show, you know, out there in Las Vegas, and we got the award out there. And that was the first time Angel had been back together in 30-some-odd years. I mean, I'd seen Frank and Barry, but I hadn't seen Greg in all that time. And everybody got together. Everybody was pretty emotional. Greg got teary-eyed and all that kind of stuff. You know, we had dinner. So then we started talking, and Frank and I said, well, maybe we'll do something in the future, you know. So we thought maybe the time is right now. Let's try that. We got some auditions from Japan, so we're working on that right now. And
nice.
we have some UK dates coming up, too, which is great. We're going to be doing these dates here. We're booking more dates in the States here. So people want to see that. So, I mean, I love Frank. You know what I mean? Still, he sings as great as he ever has. You know, he's still a great singer. A lot of guys, you know, his age can't hit those notes anymore. Frank can. You know, he even sounds better, actually. So it's going to be fun. We're going to have a great time.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't wait. I'm really excited when you guys come into Philadelphia next month.
I've been doing all kinds of stuff. Yeah, trying to get ready to go. I always have these costume mates. I have this Russian seamstress here. She's really good. She's only been here for 10 years, and so I'll design something that I want to wear, and I go get the material, and I give it to her, and she sews it up. It's really cool. So I get to play all those things I did in the past. Like, and even in Angel, I designed all my own costumes. I never had the costume designers design mine because they always wanted to put you in some kind of a robe or something, you know, some kind of like white hanging robe. I said, I don't want to be that, man. So if you look at my costumes compared to the other guys' costumes, mine are completely different because I would design my own. I've always been artistic like that with the hair and, you know, designing my own costumes and the whole thing. I've just always. That's my first Elvis Presley, man. I fell madly in love. You know, and I said, that is the coolest fucking guy in the world, man. Damn, I would look at Elvis Presley standing, he would have his backup singers, the Jordanaires, behind him. He looked like he was from Mars. He was so beautiful, man, with that hair all popping his head and all greasy and shit. and those eyes and those lips. I thought, that guy's the coolest guy in the world. He was pretty, but he was tough and at the same time. You know what I mean? And the Jordanaires would be behind me. They looked like a bunch of hillbillies. You know? And Elvis had all the girls screaming for him and stuff. I said, that's what I want to be one day. You know? So I just always got into, I used to walk around when I was a kid with my lip up in the air and stuff, you know, all that kind of shit. I had my hair all greased back, and I had the ducktails in the back and all that kind of stuff, you know. I must look funny as hell, though, because I was a little skinny guy, you know, but... I've always loved all that kind of stuff. You know, I used to always draw and stuff too. You know, so I like creating things like that. You know, and I like creating my own image too. I've always been a lion. I've never been a zebra. My middle name is Lionel, which means lion. You know, and I've always stood apart from the herd. You know what I mean? I've always tried to do something different. You know, and do my own thing. You know what I mean? I just like doing that. You know,
Did you ever get tired of wearing the white all the time?
That's a funny thing. At one point, you know, we did that Bad Publicity cover thing. You know, we felt like maybe we were being typecast. You know, and David Krebs used to always kind of piss me. David Krebs always made us feel like I regretted not signing with him. And I wanted to sign with David Krebs and Lieber and Krebs back then. You know, they managed Aerosmith and AC/DC and Nugent back then. They wanted to sign us up. And I remember I had a conference call with David Krebs and Greg and Mickey and I. And David said, if you don't sign with us, it's just a mental masturbation. We can break you guys big as hell. You know, because I know I have Aerosmith. I have a ditch on Columbia. Or whatever it was, the record they were on, and that kind of stuff. But the other guys wanted to go out to California, be with Toby Organization, so we did that. But David and I always stayed in touch, you know what I mean? So you know, he always said he would have kept us in the rock and roll clothes, and I was always in rock and roll clothes. I could do my own thing, you know what I mean? That more like the Aerosmith kind of thing, look, you know what I mean? So we thought after a while, maybe we're being typecast. Maybe we should try to do something different, try to be more of a rock and roll band look, you know what I mean? And so we did that Bad Publicity album cover. We were all just dressed in our rock clothes and that sort of thing. And I remember Neil Bogart saw that cover, and he said, I did not sign the punk band. You guys get back in the studio, you know, and get something. That's when the Senville cover came out. But, of course, they printed a lot of those Bad Publicity sleeves up first, and so they're worth a lot of money nowadays. They're hard to find. But they did the Senville thing. And then, of course, our last tour we did, we did it with David Krebs at Rock and Roll Marathon, and we decided to go out without our white. And we went out, you know, dressed in our street rock and roll clothes. You know, I had leopard jackets and all that kind of stuff, and Frank had all kind of red leather pants and that sort of thing. And you know, and a lot of the kids were disappointed. You know, you're not wearing white. You know what I mean? And I thought, well, you know, because we wanted to try something different. You know, I could see that. But the thing, I didn't really realize how. I can see why they're disappointed, because like I said, when Facebook came out, I started seeing all these pictures of Angel playing on stage all in white. It did look fucking cool, man. It was like, yeah. I became all of a sudden a fan myself of Angel, because before that, I was in Angel. I wasn't a fan as much as I was just doing it as my thing. But then after seeing all those pictures on Facebook and stuff of us all dressed in white and, you know, falling on our knees and stuff and everything, I said, that looks fucking cool and shit. I mean, I can see why the people dug it, you know. And so, you know, you're too close to it. You don't know what's best for you, you know what I mean, a lot of times. You know what I mean? You know, you get hung up in the moment, you know, and you think, you know. But I can see now why, and it wasn't a mistake. Angels should have always been in white, and the kids loved it, and I can see why they liked it. I became a fan all of a sudden. I said, that's cool shit, man. I want to see some more of that, too, because I didn't have any pictures or anything of us, because when I was out in L.A. and I finally left, I was living with Barry, and I had some suitcases, and somebody stole all my pictures, everything. I had, like, two suitcases full of stuff, and somebody stole it all. So I wound up coming back to the East with just my guitar and some clothes, you know, and that was it. So I never really saw much of my girlfriend at the time, though. She would get stuff. Like, she got all the CDs, and when they came out, she got all of those. She got all the album covers, and I got my gold record and that sort of thing. But I didn't really see a lot about Angel. I just left it in the past all the time when I was doing the tanning salons. I didn't even think about it, really, you know what I mean? And then when I saw on Facebook, I thought, wow. You know, it really was cool, man. You know, so I was happy. I said, you know, if we didn't make any money, at least we made a lot of people happy. So that's just as important, if not more so, you know.
Absolutely. Now, do you think with you and Frank doing these shows, this might lead to the eventual return of Angel at some point?
You know, I don't know. Like I said, somebody's going to have to bankroll it. I don't know. You know, like I said, and if we were going to do it, it would be I would do Angel for maybe 2 days at the Hard Rock or something out there in Las Vegas. You know, rehearse for
right.
a month or so, put together a nice big stage show. Maybe do 2 days that they have people fly in to see us, whatever. If they would do that, if it would sell like that, and just do 2 shows and cap it off, and that would be the end of it. I would never put Angel
sure.
together and try to go on tour and be a big tour. So I would never do that. Something like that would work, but I mean, that's a possibility. But like again, I really don't know. You know, it depends on what everybody's feeling. You know, that sort of thing. You know.
Sure. Wow.
So I'm so busy doing my thing, and I'm so happy with this. I mean, I love my record so much. I mean, I play that record every day in my fucking car. When I got driving in my Hummer, I play it every single day because not because it's me, because I love the songs. I love the. I mean, my guitar player is so much better now than it was back then for me. That's why, because I used to hear my Angel records and I would kind of cringe a lot of times. You know what I mean? Like, okay, do the Angel on that, on to the next one. You know what I mean? And then, but this,
right.
this album, I love to listen to. You know, and I just like it. So I'm happy doing that. You know.
That's awesome. And when I talked to Danny the other day, he said you guys are already working on the next one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Danny's really prolific, too. I'm always writing songs. So Danny and I, you know, I'll get these ideas together, you know, and then I'll sit down with Danny and, you know, I'll write a bridge for him, or he'll write a chorus for me or something or whatever. We'll sit down and put these things together, and I'm always writing. So, yeah, I've got a lot of really neat stuff coming up. You know, when we do the next album, it's going to even be better because now I've – you know, the first album, you know, I had all these songs that I had written, you know what I mean? But now I kind of know what I'd like to do. I'd like to do something more diverse. Because my last album was pretty diversified, you know what I mean?
Right.
The songs were, and I like that, you know. A lot of bands, you hear the first song, you've heard the whole album. I mean, I love AC/DC, don't get me wrong, I love them to death. But, you know, you hear one AC/DC song, you've heard all the songs pretty much, you know what I mean?
Right.
It plows right through, which is cool. I mean, I think that's great. I love them. I mean, they kick my ass, you know. But my album's more diversified, and I like to do that. I think that's from growing up with the Beatles and stuff. Every Beatles album that came out with, the next one was different than the last one, you know what I mean? They did all kinds
yeah.
of different types of songs. And the Beatles even did country music. I mean, they did Act Naturally, you know, that's a country song, and they did that Carl Perkins songs, too. I mean, they did country stuff, too, you know, and so... You know, that's what I love about the Beatles. They were so diversified. And like I said, I have so many influences in my musical background that I'd like to do. Like, if you listen to Shadow Man, that's kind of that that's a horn line. It's like a Motown horn line, you know. And all those songs are, you know, they're just diverse. So anyway, so I'm rambling on here. But I have a lot of really great ideas now for some really cool songs. I have one called 1975 that's going to be really cool. Take me back to 1975. I want to go back in time, 1975. But it's got really cool chorus. That's kind of like almost like All the Young Dudes kind of chorus. It's really, really cool like that. But the verses are like in a kind of a minory kind of picking kind of thing, almost like a Stairway to Heaven, but not quite as minor is that, but then it goes into a real
okay.
major chorus that's in the G major, like I said, E minor versus, you know, that kind of climbing down scale with finger picking kind of acoustic things going on, and then it goes into a G major for the chorus, and it really kicks ass, and it's really cool, and it's just a real good vibe, too, the way, talking about how everybody was cool tonight, the guys and the girls were cool in 1975, taking back in time, you know, 1975, and then at the end, I'm going to recite every band from back in then, because the chorus is going to go on and on and on, and then we're going to scream, Mata Hoofle. We're going to scream, Kiss. We're going to scream, Angel. We're going to scream, Cheek. We're going to shit scream all those bands at the end of the course as it's carrying on out. So it's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be fun.
Will ABBA be mentioned in there?
Oh, maybe. Maybe. Yeah, why not? Why not? That would be funny as shit. But I know right now that the guys in the band are like, don't say ABBA.
Come on, you got to do an SOS cover. That's all.
Yeah, I want to kind of give a salute to everybody from back then. You know, not just 75, even further on, like Queen. I mean, you know, Queen. Everybody from back then. I like to do that. That would just be a fun song, you know, to carry on out. And then I got all kinds of other really cool songs, like some really heavy rockers and that sort of thing. But I've got some really nice ballads that are really nice. I have one that's really beautiful, but I'm not sure if I got to find the right singer to do this one. But it's a really great song. It's almost like a Ray Charles song almost, but it's.
Oh wow!
It's really cool, but
very, very cool.
Yeah,
Punky, I want to thank you for doing this, and actually too, your keyboard player Charlie, he's the one he writes interviewed you about the Angel at Midnight movie for our website.
Right, yeah. I love Charlie. Charlie's a great guy. He's a great musician, but he's a great guy. And Charlie helps out a lot with this whole project. You know, he's got all these people he knows and stuff. So Charlie's a great guy. I love him to death.
He's
great.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
That's the great thing about this band. Everybody is, there's not any egos involved. Everybody is just really nice, friendly, and cool, and they do their thing, and they're good at it, you know, and they have a good time. And it's a fun
band. They're a bunch of good guys. I love Charlie to death. He's a great guy.
That's awesome. Well,
it's my pleasure. Okay, thanks, Bay.
Can I get you kind of an ID before I let you go? One thing.
Sure.
You can say Punky Meadows, and you're listening to Totally Driven Radio.
Okay. Hi, this is Punky Meadows, and you're listening to Totally Driven Radio.
Awesome. Punky, thank you so much, and see you next month at the track in Philly.
All right, man. Awesome. It's nice talking to you, Bay. Talk to you later.
You too. Take care.
All right. Bye. You too. Bye.
Shadow, your shadow man, yes I am.
everybody. Welcome back to the University of Rocks. Bay Ragney here, and there you go, and there it is, and there it was. Our interview with Punky Meadows and the music of Punky Meadows with Frank Domino and Angel, all of it. We did. You just heard off the Punky solo album, Shake Shake, and before that, Shadow Man. And before our interview with Punky, we did from Angel, Can You Feel It? And Lost and Lonely with Frank Domino on vocals. So there you go. I hope everybody enjoyed all the music and the interview with Punky. I hope you learned something. I hope you go see Punky and Frank in concert. I will be. They're coming here to the Philadelphia area on April 12th. So check them out. A bunch of cool bands opening up. Friends of ours as well. The band Rat Rod is one of the openers. So make sure you go. If you see me, come up and say hi. Let me know how you like the interview. Let me know if you're totally driven. And make sure you tell Frank and Punky and Danny that you are also totally driven and you heard their interview. And it's going to be a great night of rock and roll in Philadelphia. Go to Punky's website for all the information. Check him out on Facebook. Like him, love him, follow him. And he's also on Twitter as well. And get the album. Get it. Pick it up. Get him to sign it. While you're there, that's what I plan to do. I plan to get my my album signed. So you should too. So there you go. Everybody, thank you again for tuning in. Thanks for being Totally Driven. Make sure you like, love, follow Totally Driven Entertainment on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, as well as myself, Bay Ragney. Just look for me. Like me, love me, follow me. Give me a friend request, and let's rock out together. Again, thanks for tuning in. And sometimes I do Sunday nights, but this Sunday is Easter, so we're going to take a Sunday night off. But next Wednesday morning, another little special promotional preview of what's in store for these shows coming up with Punky and Frank and Danny and the boys. Check it out. Frank Domino interview next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. to tune in. All right, everybody, thanks again. Stay driven. See ya.